Campus FM presents A Book, A Thousand Stories. A review of the book, The Hare with Amber Eyes, by Edmond de Waal. Production and presentation, Patricia Salomone. Musical advice by Gerald Fennec, and technical support by Samuel Attard and Carmelo Grech. In last week's episode, we reviewed chapters in which our author told us much about his uncle Iggy and his longtime friend and partner Jiro in Tokyo. Japan recovered fast from the ravages of war. De Waal writes that in the 7 years of occupation, since the war, Japan has been rebuilt, partly through American subsidies, but substantially by the Japanese people's entrepreneurial skills. The story is now coming to a full circle, but listen on. By the early 1960s, Iggy was a long-term resident. Europeans and Americans came on three-year postings and left. But Iggy stayed. He loved Tokyo. He loved the way the skyline changed, the new apartment blocks hard against the smoky yakitori booths. He identified with the city's capacity for reinventation. There was a correlation between Vienna in 1919 and Tokyo in 1947. When life reaches so low an ebb, the ability to rise again gives one a sensation of exaltation. Cities too seem to feel this rebirth.
In September 1945, General Douglas MacArthur took charge of the Supreme Command of Allied Power, SCAP, and began the work of rebuilding Japan. Although Great Britain, the Soviet Union, and the Republic of China had an advisory role as a part of an Allied Council, MacArthur had the final authority to make all decisions. The occupation of Japan can be divided into three phases. The initial effort to punish and reform Japan, the work to resolve the Japanese economy, and the conclusion of the formal peace treaty and alliance. The first phase, roughly from the end of the war in 1945 through 1947, involved the most fundamental change for the Japanese government and society. The Allies punished Japan for its past militarism and expansion by convincing the war crime trial in Tokyo. At the same time, SCAP dismantled the Japanese army and banned former military officer from the taking roles of the political leadership in the new government. In the economic field, SCAP introduced a land reform designed to benefit the majority tenant farmers and reduce the power of rich landowners, many of whom had advocated of the war, supported Japanese expansionism in the 1930s. MacArthur also tried to break up the large Japanese business conglomerate, or Zaibatsu, as a part of the effort to transform the economy into free market capitalist system. In 1947, Allied advisor essentially decided to the new constitution to Japan's leaders. Some of the most profound changing in the document included downgrading the emperor status, to that of the figurehead without political control and placing more power in the parliamentary system, promoting greater rights and privileges for women, and eliminating all non-defensive armed forces. By late 1947 and early 1948, the emergence of the economic crisis in Japan, alongside concern about the spread of communism, sparked reconsideration of occupation policies. This period is sometimes called the reverse course. In this stage of occupation, which lasted until 1950, the economic rehabilitation of Japan took center stage. SCAP became concerned that the weak Japanese economy would increase the influence of the domestic communist movement, and with the communist victory in China's civil war, increasing likely the future of East Asia appeared to be at stake. Occupation policies to address the weakness of economy range from tax reform to measures aimed at controlling inflation. However, the most serious of problem was the shortage of raw materials required to feed Japanese industries and market for finished goods. The outbreak of the Korean War in 1950 provided SCAP with just opportunity it needed to address this problem, prompting some occupation officials to suggest that Korea came along and save us. After the UN entered the Korean War, Japan became the principal supply depot for UN forces. The conflict also placed Japan firmly within the confines of the US defense in Asia, assuring the Japanese leadership that no real threat would be made against Japanese soil. In the third phase of occupation, beginning in 1950, SCAP deemed the political and economic future of Japan firmly established and set about securing formal peace treaty to end both the war and the occupation. The US perception of international threat had changed so profoundly in the year between 1945 and 1950 that the idea of rearmed and militarist Japan no longer alarmed US officials. Instead, the real threat appeared to be the creep of communism, particularly in Asia. The final agreement allowed the United States to maintain its bases in Okinawa and elsewhere in Japan, and the US government promised Japan a security pact.
Iggy had turned himself into a businessman, the sort of person his father Victor would have been proud of. In fact, he was much more successful with making money than his father, who had presided over a spectacular series of downfalls. De Waal finds a copy of a letter Iggy wrote to the general manager of the Swiss Bank Corporation in Zurich, Switzerland, to whom Iggy stated, "Suffice it to say that I started in Japan from scratch and have been able over the years to build an organization with a yearly turnover of 100 million yen." He maintained offices in Tokyo and Osaka, employing some 45 people. He was the vice president of the Swiss Bank in Tokyo. He had become a banker, after all. 100 years after his grandfather Ignaz had opened the bank in Schottengasse in Vienna. A wealthy man, he helped his siblings and nephews. And when this nephew, Edmund, visited, he could see for himself how his uncle had made a good life for himself in Japan. Iggy and Jiro moved to a new apartment block, where they had adjoining apartments with separate front doors, but with a door from one dressing room to the other. some of the Vienna pictures had migrated to Jiro's side, and some of Jiro's Japanese porcelain ended up on Iggy's shelves. A photograph of Emmy stood next to a photograph of Jiro's mother in a little shrine. Iggy and Jiro went on holidays together, and nearly 40 years after Iggy had last left his birthplace, he took Jiro to Vienna, and there, before the Effrussi Palais, which had been his home, he took two important decisions. One was to revoke his American citizenship and take up Austrian citizenship once more. The other was to adopt Jiro, who became Jiro Effrussi Sugiyama. So Iggy was Austrian, then American, then Austrian living in Japan. A strange, winding path in search of an identity. Back in Tokyo, 15 years after his uncle Iggy's death, Edmund visits Jiro. Jiro has left Iggy's apartment unchanged since he died. The pens are still in their holder, and the blotter is still central on the desk. Edmund stays in Uncle Iggy's apartment. Jiro is now in his 80s, and he reminisces about his life with Iggy after their first meeting. The two share tales and stories, look at old photographs, family members long gone, family treasures showing up in antique magazines, a pink and gold Fabergé egg that opens to reveal a diamond-studded cockerel which belonged to Iggy's aunt Beatrice Effrussi Rothschild, which has become the most expensive Russian object ever auctioned. Together, Edmund and Jiro open the vitrine and reach out for a Netsuke. It is 2 years since the Wild began to work on writing his book. He feels the pull of his pottery work. He must get back to the clay. His clients are getting impatient. But there still is one inescapable step. De Waal writes, I need to go to Odessa. It is nearly 2 years since I began this journey, and I've been everywhere else but the city where the Effrussi family started. He needs to go to Odessa to see for himself, to understand why they left, what it means to leave. I'm not sure that I will understand, De Waal writes. He will be surprised to find out that it is not at all as he expected. He travels there with his brother Thomas, who has been researching the history of the Effrussi of Odessa for many years. The two brothers pass by ravaged apartment blocks and decaying factories until they meet the wide avenues of Odessa. No one told me, De Waal writes, that it was so beautiful. He describes Primorsky Boulevard as a run of classical buildings washed in yellows and pale blues, which stretch on both sides of Potemkin steps, made famous in Eisenstein's film. There are famous landmarks, Pushkin's statue, a cannon won from the British during the Crimean War, a statue of the Duc de Richelieu, governor of the city in the early 19th century, Catherine the Great, just recently reinstalled, the Opera House, modeled on the Vienna Oper. As the two brothers walk along the elegant promenade past the Hôtel de Ville, they reach what used to be the Euphrosy Bank with the family house next door. This is where Jules, Ignace and Charles were born. This is also where Victor, their great-grandfather, was born. It is a mess with the stucco cracking. But up, right at the top, is a single balcony in which the doubly of the family hangs on. There are workmen around, and dust, and skips, and broken stone. The place has just been renovated. The old building is but a shell. The inside has all been gutted and redone.
We had to get rid of the old house. You should have seen it a month ago.
Alas, the Wall concludes that he is too late. The house is now to be the headquarters of the Marine Inspection Office. He is about to leave when he doubles back and, putting his hand on the cast iron balustrade, notices that each column is topped with a blackened ear of wheat. The Euphrosy wheat, the Euphrosy symbol, the wheat from the black soil of the Ukraine that had made the family fortune. But why, the Wall asks himself, why did they leave?
Wenn ich der Mann sich in meine Kinderjugend bingt, wie ein Hulem, wird mir alles vor.
I thought the Euphrosy boys left Odessa to get their education in Vienna and Paris, writes the Wall. He thought Charles had left to go on his grand tour to discover the classics, but he realizes he is wrong. Here in Odessa, 100 yards from their house, was a museum that held rooms and rooms of antiques, Greek artifacts. This dusty city, with its stevedores, sailors, stokers, fishermen, divers, smugglers, adventurers, swindlers, was a city full of writers and artists, too. The Euphrosy were not lacking in cultural stimulus. Yet, from this polyglot city, they set off after old books on Dürer, or adventures in love, or the next great grain deal. Yet some traces are left. After one of the pogroms, the Euphrosy founded an orphanage and a school for Jewish children. For 30 years, the Euphrosy brothers settled in Paris and Vienna donated money to these institutions for the purchase of educational equipment, an astrolabe, a steel knife for cutting glass, a skeleton and a demountable model of an eye, and books, books by Beecher Stowe, Swift, Tolstoy, Cowper, Thackeray and Scott. With the remainder, there is money to purchase coats, blouses and trousers for the 25 poor Jewish boys so that they can read Ivanhoe or Vanity Fair without shivering, covered up from the Odessan dust. Odessa's dust hits the author's imagination. He sees here too, in this cosmopolitan town, a city in the making, with its wind-blown, dusty streets at the time when the Ifrusi migrated to the dusty Monceau Hill and the dusty Ringstrasse, these areas of Paris and Vienna, which were also in the making. The Ifrusi children grew up with dust, De Waal writes. Suddenly, the Ifrusi boys are there. They are in the Yiddish tales of Sholem Aleichem, in the stories of Isaac Babel. The Yiddish saying likened the Jews living in Odessa as living like gods. And the Ifrusi were living like gods on this Zionstrasse. Edmund and Thomas arranged to meet Sasha, an elderly Odessan scholar who may remember the family. At this point, Edmund brings out an envelope which he has found back in Iggy's flat in Tokyo. Sasha goes through the worn-out papers. He deciphers and explains. Here is the imperial notification from the Tsar empowering Ignaz, the builder of the Vienna Palais, to wear the Bessarabian medal, amongst other documents. Edmund realizes these are papers his great-grandfather, Victor, had saved and passed on to his daughter, Elizabeth. This is the family archive, which is to be safely saved for posterity. Before leaving Odessa, the brothers pass by a synagogue. They get a glimpse of a seder chair. It is yellow. In a flash, Edmund sees Charles's yellow armchair placed among the Degas and the Moreau, and the cabinet of Netzuke on show there in the Salon in Paris. Edmund takes the Netzuke collection to his home in England, buys a second-hand vitrine discarded by the Victoria and Albert Museum, and the 264 figurines find a new home in our author's London home, next to the piano and unlocked so that the children can open the door if they wish to. And so The Hare with Amber Eyes comes to an end, its author exhausted after 2 years of looking at scribbles at the margins of books, letters used as bookmarks, photographs of the 19th century cousins, Odessan patents of this and of that, envelopes and sad aerograms announcing calamitous news. His fingers are tacky from dust. He has handled diaries in German, old newspapers, and the Netzuke collection. He has the sense of living on the edges of other people's lives without permission. At this point, De Waal stumbles to a halt. Is this book about his family, or memory, or himself, or is it a book about a collection of little Japanese things? Charles's yellow armchair and his collection of impressionist paintings in the Salon in Paris go through his mind, as does Emmy's dressing room in Vienna, where Anna lays out her hats and gloves while the children play with the minuscule Japanese trinkets. Emmy's dressing table crashes through the glass skylight, scattering love letters and family papers on the courtyard floor. The family home in Kovacek's has become a trap, and Emmy abuses of her heart pills to bow out of life. Anna and Elizabeth meet after the war years, and Anna recounts the story of the saving of the Netsuke. Elizabeth and Iggy repeat the story to Edmund, and as you take an object from your pocket, you put it down in front of you and you start. You begin to tell a story. Having come to the end of the story, may I say that I hope you enjoyed the 17 episodes of this program, A Book, A Thousand Stories, the review of the book The Hare with Amber Eyes by Edmund de Waal. With the help of Gerald Fennec, who helped so much with the choice of music, I hope to have created a radio program that you could visualize. This is the magic of the radio. For their input relating to history, art, and general culture, I thank Professor Sandra Dingley, Professor Dominic Fennec, Professor Henry Frendo, Akiko Miyahara, Krista Follman, Caroline Mijani, George Peresso, and Albert Storace. Finally, for the dedication and care on the technical side, I am sincerely grateful to Samuel Attard. A Book, A Thousand Stories is over, but you can listen again on Campus FM webcasts.